7, Stan Phillips.
Mansions of glory and suicide machines sprung from cages on highway nine, torn with human ticket and stepping out over the line.
Some 866.
Good morning, Met fans. Happy hump day to you. How you doing? Well, last night we didn't do what we thought we could do. We knew this series was going to be a battle. Bats were kind of quiet, and we lost a tough one to the Braves. So the series is tied up at 1-1 with the rubber game early today, 12 o'clock. Get your lunch ready early so we can sit down and watch the Metsies. But let's talk about yesterday's game. 4-1 loss to the Braves and a rough outing for Seth Lugo, who hasn't been the Seth Lugo we've known this year. Now, like I said, the Mets lost 4-1. Series is even at 1-1. And this afternoon's game is going to be a very important rubber game in the series. And it'll feature Chris Bassitt pitching against veteran right-hander Charlie Morton. With the loss, the Mets saw their lead over the Braves in the NL East reduced to 1.5 games. Now, the most obvious advantage the Braves have over the Mets is their power. And it proved to be the difference on Tuesday night as two home runs by Matt Olson and Adam Duvall accounted for all of Atlanta runs. The Braves have now hit 136 home runs, and that's the highest total in the National League and second in the majors. The Braves are a powerful team all around, and the fact that they lead the league in homers gives them... This team is to be reckoned with. It's not going to be easy. By comparison, the Mets have hit 86, ranking them 11th in the National League. Now, the power difference aside, the problem for the Mets lately is that their high-contact style, which was so productive the first 2 months of the season, isn't putting in up runs in recent weeks. Since June 1, they are averaging 4 runs a game compared to 5.3 in April and May. As a result, they are 20-17 in June and July, while the Braves have gone 30-9, shaving 9 games off the Mets' 10.5-game lead. This week, the Mets' offense is further compromised by the absence of Starling Marte, who remains day-to-day with a left groin strain, and Jeff McNeil, who is on paternity leave and not expected back until the Mets go to Chicago to play the Cubs on Thursday. The Mets also continue to have a major hole in the DH spot. Although Dominic Smith played first base as Pete Alonso took a turn at DH, Smith and J.D. Davis are getting most of the DH at-bats. Smith went 0-for-4 on Tuesday, lowering his average to 2.03. Davis went hitless on Monday night. He's now hitting .241 with a .685 OPS. And between them, they have just hit 3 home runs. Now, the Met bullpen problems are becoming more and more glaring. They were fortunate to get away with using Adam Ottavino in the 8th inning on Monday as he escaped the 2nd and 3rd jam. And overall, Ottavino is having a pretty good season. But because he's prone to hanging his slider and giving up home runs, he's not the best choice to be the primary setup man. Now, as we all know, that was probably supposed to be Seth Lugo when the season began, but Lugo has been very inconsistent this season. He hurt the Mets on Tuesday night, giving up a 2-run homer to Duvall on a hanging slider in the 7th inning as the Braves extended their lead to 4-1. Lugo's ERA rose to 3.98. While he's had his share of dominant outings, too often his stuff hasn't been crisp, especially his curveball that once was so effective because of its high spin rate. Perhaps most notably, Lugo has given up 33 hits in 33 2/3 innings, as well as 9 walks. And when you're a reliever, you really can't afford to be putting that many men on base. Now, the Mets couldn't have asked much more for David Peterson night when he held one of the most explosive lineups in the majors, scoreless over the first 5 innings, and wound up giving up 2 runs in 5 1/3 innings, both on Olson's home run to center in the 6th. The Braves are now 22-9 versus lefty starters this season, yet Peterson dominated them through 5 innings, striking out 9 while allowing 2 hits and 2 walks. The Mets lefty now is 5-2 with a 3.48 ERA, and he has been a solid back end of the rotation starter, but he may be blossoming into something more than that, at least judging by how he's racking up strikeouts lately. He now has 40 Ks in his last 5 starts, and that is fantastic. He's doing a good job against right-handed hitters of pitching inside with a slider, and that slider has been amazing, and outside with his fastball and changeup. He really has become a complete pitcher, and he has to stick around. He is good. Him and Tyler McGill have been the pleasant surprises this year. Francisco Lindor, he continues to deliver in RBI situations. His batting average may not reflect it, but his two-out triple up the right center gap in the fifth inning gave the Mets a 1-0 lead and knocked Braves starter Spencer Strider out of the game. For Lindor, it was RBI number 61, tying him at the time with Trey Turner for the most among shortstops in the majors. As it turned out, Turner's two-run home run Tuesday night gave him 63 for the season. Lindor is also fifth in the NL overall in RBIs. So while Lindor's overall numbers are good, but not great as he was passed over for the All-Star game, the Mets shortstop has been dependable in the clutch. For the season, he's hitting .278 with runners in scoring position, and he has been very good with two outs and runners in scoring position. His triple raised his average in no situations to .314, 11 for 35. Now, Strider made it clear he's going to be a force for the Mets to deal with this season and beyond. The Braves' rookie sensation lasted only 4 2/3 innings as the Mets did a nice job of working his pitch count to 103, forcing him out of the game early. Yet he showed dominant stuff, racking up 8 strikeouts while allowing only 1 run. Making his 9th start since being inserted into the starting rotation, he pitched out of the bullpen early in the season. He now has 110 strikeouts for the season. He came into the game averaging 14 strikeouts per 9 innings, the highest average among MLB starters. Strider was quite a find for the Braves as a 4th-round pick out of Clemson in the 2020 draft. Scouts already consider him the steal of the draft as he's arrived in the big league faster than expected, especially considering he had Tommy John surgery in 2019 and had a shortened college season in 2020 due to the COVID-19 pandemic. So that's another guy we're going to have to be watching out for is Spencer Strider. Now, here are some audio highlights from yesterday's game.
And Lindor pokes one into right center field for a base hit, and the Mets will take the lead. Nimmo comes home to score and gets by Acuna. Lindor around second. He's on his way to third. And the Mets have a 1-0 lead in the fifth.
Peterson wants it away.
And Olsen flies it to deep center field. Back goes Nimmo to the warning track. At the wall, it's out of here. Matt Olsen gives the Braves the lead with a 2-run homer. And it's 2-1 Atlanta. And Duvall gets one in the air down the left field line. Right toward the pole. That ball is out of here. Adam Duvall with a 2-run homer. And it's 4-1 Atlanta. 3-2 coming. And Nito hits one past the mound. Swanson is there to field it. He throws out Nito and the ball game is over. 4 1/3 hitless innings for the Atlanta bullpen.
And there you have it. Do we call them highlights or lowlights? But pick up our chins and we bounce back early this afternoon to see how we do against the Braves this afternoon. Here's David Peterson talking about his effort yesterday.
A tough lineup to navigate. What were you able to do so effectively against them tonight?
I think we were able to get ahead. And then I think use all the weapons to kind of finish guys off and get some outs and get through some of those innings.
You've talked a lot about how getting ahead has been the biggest difference. Just what is the biggest change when you're able to get ahead consistently for you out there with what you're able to do?
I think you get ahead and you have the count in your advantage. You know, you have you put the pressure more on the hitter and you have more to work with. You know, you can throw some off speed out of the zone. You can get more chase swings when you're ahead in the count than when you're behind. I mean, guys get super patient and they're usually looking for a pitch that they have in mind. And so when you get ahead, you kind of, especially as you go through the game and they've seen what you're throwing, then they have more to think about and more to consider.
What do you think of the 2-2 pitch to Swanson?
I haven't seen it yet. I heard it was a strike. I thought it was a strike in real time. But that's the way baseball goes. You know, you get some and that are off and you don't get some that are in the zone. So I wasn't really super focused on it going into the next at bat. I was trying to get Olsen out the next at bat and it was really more when I came out, I had heard that it was a clear strike. So
when the whole night goes well except for the very end, what ends up being the primary takeaway for you?
Well, I mean, I think it's against a good team like this. I mean, we're both at the top in the division fighting for that spot, and obviously they've been playing well, we had the lead, and so I obviously don't want to give up the lead there. You know, I want to keep us in that ball game and keep the lead. I was just wanted to, after the walk, get Olsen and then go after Riley and get out of that inning. So I mean, it sucks. I missed my spot, and he's a good hitter, and he took advantage of it.
A little more.
I was trying to go more away. It was in the zone middle. I would have liked it to be just above the zone and outside.
So there you have it. There's David Peterson. I am very impressed with him this year. I did not expect him to be having this kind of year. And to be honest with you, he has that live arm. And he has perfected that slider like you would not believe in. He is going to be a keeper. I keep saying that for the past week or so, and I was not a believer, but Peterson has me sold. He has the stuff and the goods to be a good starter. Now, one guy we are all missing is Starling Marte. He continues to recover from a groin injury, and though he's not on the IL, it's an ongoing situation with the Mets. He did tell media members that he's feeling better and the pain has subsided a bit. However, he still needs a couple more days to work through it before he gets back in the lineup. So it appears likely Marte won't be available for the series finale this afternoon, but we'll see for sure when the lineup comes out. The All-Star could be ready for the four-game Cubs set in Chicago before the All-Star break instead. And I think that's what we'll be shooting for, is the Cubs. That's going to be a big series. We've got to win at least three there. So having Marte in the lineup will be a big bonus for us and maybe a big boost. Now, what's potentially going to be a big boost for the Mets come trade deadline? Well, how about some trades? The Mets do need bullpen help. And to be honest with you, the bridge to Edwin Diaz really hasn't been strong this year. And Billy Epler almost has to do what Sandy Alderson did in 2015 when the team added Addison Reed and Tyler Clippard, two veteran relievers who had good stuff and could be good, great setup men. But the specifics of the bullpen market are yet to clarify. So we'll take a minute here to provide our speculation on three non-relievers that the Mets may want to look after. The Mets are interested in Trey Mancini to fill their other biggest need, designated hitter. Mancini can also play first base and outfield and wouldn't cost a top prospect. However, the Orioles are in contention. It may not be real come the end of the year, but they are still in the mix. Now, other clubs have been told that the O's are in a holding pattern for at least another week. Now, Baltimore is on the road until the All-Star break, after which they play the Yankees at home. By then, interested teams like the Mets believe they might have a clearer path as far as where Mancini may be going. Will he be staying? Will he be going? And how about Brandon Drury? A year ago, Drury was one of several runs for Bryn Alderson, Jeff LeBeau, and the entire Mets scouting department, which found a bench mob among a group of off-season minor league free agents. Now Drury has come into his own with the Reds, hitting 18 homers and posting an .873 OPS. He's almost been all-star-like. A right-handed hitter who is more productive and more versatile than J.D. Davis. Drury would represent an upgrade there, but league sources say the Dodgers and Giants are showing more interest in Drury at this point. And how about Merrill Kelly? The Mets need starting pitching depth this year and the starting pitching period for next year. 2023, the Mets could be without free agents to be Jacob deGrom, Taijuan Walker, and Chris Bassitt. Arizona Diamondbacks right-hander Merrill Kelly could help on both counts. Now, he isn't a top-of-the-rotation starter, but the Mets will need arms in the coming years, and Kelly is under control through the 2024 season. This year, he is 8-5 with a 3.36 ERA, with underlying numbers that are largely above average. We mention him here because the Mets did extensive background work on Kelly as a potential trade target this past winter, so he may very well be in the Met mix. We shall see. And Sandy Alderson has come out and said that a hitter and some bullpen help is what the Mets need. Now, Alderson knows Disney hitter has been up to par with the rest of the league. And he says once you take Pete Alonso out of it, once he's played DH or filled in at DH, it's been very poor. But he doesn't think the market is going to be too expensive to find an impact bat. He said, is a DH spot going to be highly competitive in the marketplace? Alderson doesn't know. Maybe he doubts it. Doesn't mean our team in our division may not try to hold us for a top prospect, but again, an opportunity to improve there. It's funny he mentions a team in the division considering first base DH Josh Bell as someone who could be moved, given the Nats are at the bottom of the NL East. Another inexpensive area in his bullpen eyes is the bullpen. And all that said, you probably noticed we lost 3 or 4 games in the last 20 with home runs in the late games after the starters depart. That can't continue with a championship team. We can't keep giving up bombs. To determine outcomes, is the bullpen an area we look at? Yeah. Now, there are a lot of options out there for the Mets to explore in that regard, like Cubs right-hander David Robertson, for example. Starting pitching was something brought up to Alderson as well, but with return of Scherzer and DeGrom near, it may not be much of a need compared to a want. Also, what's the price tag there? That's going to be the key to all these acquisitions, if they are to happen. What is the price tag? Starting pitching is always expensive, and it's always expensive to acquire at the deadline. And Alderson is adamant in saying that we want to preserve the prospects we have. We have some good ones. We traded one last year at the deadline to the Cubs, Pete Crow Armstrong. He was hurt at the time, but today he's ranked like 30th among all prospects in baseball. So we got to be careful about who we move and what for what reasons. So there's Sandy. He's being realistic. So probably a starting pitcher isn't going to be in the mix. We have to hope for a healthy DeGrom and Scherzer. But the bullpen, maybe we can get the right guy at the right price. And a hitter is always available, like Sandy says. There's always these bad teams that want to dump some salary. And a guy who's a good hitter and up in age is always available. So we'll see. Could very well be Josh Bell or maybe Nelson Cruz. Now, one thing we can see clearly is that the Mets-Braves rivalry is growing into a real rivalry that may last for quite a few years. This intriguing series, with the Mets having swapped 4-1 decisions heading into Wednesday's rubber game, are exactly where they started. A game and a half apart, neck and neck, and this feels exactly the way it should be. The Braves prevailed Tuesday because David Peterson's final pitch was the worst of the 105 he used to mostly muffle the Braves' potent bats before Matt Olson made number 105 disappear over the center field wall, and because Seth Lugo continues to scuffle. The Mets' depleted lineup can muster only one run. That's not going to cut it most nights against the Braves or anyone else. Now, these have been two tight, well-fought games, and we expect more of the same the rest of the way. Check this out. Not only will the Mets and Braves play 13 more games from here, they seem as evenly matched as they've been in years. Especially when the Mets aren't missing Jeff McNeil is on paternity leave, Starling Marte strained groin, and Jacob DeGrom's shoulder. That's two present All-Stars and one perennial one for those keeping score. It is enough to wonder if we aren't seeing the birth of a rivalry. The Mets and Braves have shared the NL East since 1994, and they've had a couple of interesting Septembers and met once in October 1999, a six-game NLCS that ended with a walk-off by Kenny Rogers that left Bobby Valentine screaming in agony right alongside a chorus of Met fans. That has been the exception, though. The rule has generally been this. The Braves have owned the East, as a result, have owned the Mets. They've won 16 division titles since 95. The Mets have won 2. The Braves have had extended periods of excellence, while the Mets have settled for fleeting spasms of prosperity. That should be different now. The Braves have a seemingly endless supply of young talent. The Mets have Steve Cohen's checkbook. Those things ought to keep both teams eye to eye for the rest of this season and beyond. It could create a rivalry, a true back and forth, let's take the gloves off because anything can happen at any time rivalry, which is something the Mets haven't had in truth over 35 years. Back then it was the Cardinals, and the Cardinals games between 85 and 88 were something to behold. The Cardinals and Mets detested each other. The Cards didn't care for the curtain calls and showboating the Mets of that era specialized in. And he used to drive the Mets bananas to hear the paeans and poetry written about the Cardinal way. So every one of the series they played in those years was supercharged. And more important, neither team could and did win. The Cards outlasted the Mets in classic pennant races in 85 and 87. The Mets KO'd St. Louis early in 86 and 88. They were forever in each other's faces and spaces, and it was a blast to watch. Since then, well, there was a time when it seemed like the Mets-Phillies could become something, but after the Mets' epic collapse in 2007, never really got off the ground. The Mets and Braves had some memorable moments, just not enough of them. Mostly the Braves have been the hammer. Mostly the Mets have been the nail. That should have been different this time around. So far this season, it feels different. Feels like equals squaring off. Feels like the Mets trying to throw in the Braves. Feels like the Braves recognize the Mets as their biggest impediment to winning the East again. Each team has won 3 to 6 games they played. Back in May, the Braves were scuffling but still managed a 4-game split. Now the Braves are piping hot. The Mets trying to keep their heads above water. The Mets won 4-1 Monday because Max Scherzer wasn't going to let that proceed any other way. The Braves won 4-1 on the strength of 2 swings at a bat. Wednesday won't settle anything, but both teams would sure like to make a statement that they'll have staying power until they see each other again for a 5-game series at Citi Field the first week in August. The kind of calling cards rivals leave for each other. Scherzer had called Monday night a measuring stick game, and it is the Mets who need to do the measuring because it's the Braves who won the Commissioner's Trophy last fall. But you can tell, watching the Braves, they want to send a message too. They want to remind the Mets who the champs are. It's not as heated as Mets Cardinals in the 80s, no, but a rivalry has to walk before it can run. Has to be born before it can fester. But by golly, I think we're on our way to that. What do you guys think? Well, I know what you guys think in the greatest baseball group there is for the Mets out there, New York Mets Baseball Way of Life. If you're not a member and you are on Facebook, please do join the group. It's New York Mets Baseball Way of Life. And if you're not a member of this, or you're not subscribed to this podcast, I should say, please, please, please do subscribe. We try to put one up every day for your Met listening needs, 365 days a year. So please do sign up and you'll be alerted every time one is up on your favorite carrier. Well, as we always do, in the Facebook group, we do our daily Met trivia and Jeopardy question of the day. So let's get right to that, shall we? Yes, we shall. Big your pardon, as Bob Murphy used to say. Remember Bob Murphy? What a great guy. Well, here's today's trivia question. Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso both have at least 60 RBIs before the All-Star game this year. Who were the last two Met teammates to accomplish the feat? And today's final Jeopardy. 2 clues. Are you ready for them? I hope you are. Traded with Sam Haggerty by the Cleveland Indians to the Mets in exchange for Kevin Pilecki on June 6, 2019. Was called up in late June 2019 when Noah Syndergaard was placed on a 10-day injured list with a right hamstring strain. There you have it. So let's see how you guys do. We'll check back later at the end of the podcast, as we always do, to give you the answers. Now, what's going on in the group? Well, check it out. Once again, Mike Fried gives a great write-up and analysis on last night's game. Don Kecko commemorates Jimmy Pearsall hitting a home run and walking around the bases. And we remember that on this date in 1977 in a game against the Cubs with New York third baseman Lenny Randle at the plate in the 6th inning, Shea Stadium went dark when the Big Apple suddenly experiences a blackout that eventually suspends the contest. The Mets players drive their cars onto the field during the delay, amusing the crowd by performing various antics in front of the headlights. That is one night I will never forget. I was at that game, and just driving home with my parents that day, going across the Verrazano Bridge and looking at a pitch-black Manhattan was a sight I will never, ever forget. And we also noted that Jacob deGrom goes Thursday. It's official, and it's going to be sold out in Syracuse. He pitches at MBT Bank Stadium for the Syracuse Mets, and it should be quite a game. Game time is at 6:35. I may even want to get the MILB package for that. Who knows? That's going to be a fun watch. We said, when I say Jason Shreve, what's the first thing that comes to your head? Charles O'Brien said, that's a disappointing ending to his Met career. Don Laub says, one of a rotating cast of bullpen pitchers who move around a lot. Dan Wiener said, lefty, he'll be somewhere else soon. And Mike Fried went in to say that the Mets are poised to do what they want to do. As I said, you got to check Mike out. He is the best. And we also mentioned that Edwin Diaz has struck out 51.4% of the batters he has faced. And second is Josh Hader at 43.8%. So Diaz is almost 8% higher, which is crazy. And how about Robinson Cano playing second base for the Braves? Just goes to show that anything can happen in baseball. We had a great picture of the 64 Met outfield with George Altman, Jim Hickman, Frank Thomas, and Duke Snider. Those were the days, my friend, right? We thought they'd never end. Well, that's some of the good stuff that you'll see in the group every day. And now, as we always do, it's time to honor Met birthdays, transactions, like we always do. On this date, born in 1940, reliever Jack Aker. And this date in 1960, catcher Mike Fitzgerald. As far as transactions are concerned, on this date in 1962, the Mets purchased Joe Pignatano from the Giants. Joe just passed away recently. Then on this date in 1988, the Mets signed free agent Bob McCoor. And that was Keith Hernandez's high school teammate, I believe. And this date in 1988. This date in 2007, the Mets signed free agent La Familia, Jaris Familia. And on this date in 2008, the Mets released Juan Padilla. So those are some of the things that happened on this date. Now, if you'd like, let's reminisce a little bit about Jack Aker. Jack Aker was originally signed as an outfielder by the Kansas City A's and led the Nebraska State League in stolen bases in his first year, 1959, before being converted to pitching before the 60 season. He made it to the majors as a side-arming single baller, pitching for the Kansas City Oakland A's 64-68, Pilots 69, Yankees 69-72, Cubs 72-73, Braves 74, Mets 74. Now, during an 11-year baseball career, Aker compiled 47 wins, 404 strikeouts, a 3.28 ERA, and 123 saves, and that was an impressive total at the time. On September 10, 1965, Aker pitched 6.1 innings of relief, allowing just one run to earn a win in a 10-5 victory over the Orioles. His best season in 1966 with the A's, when he led the American League in saves, 32, a major league record, until 1970, and games finished 57 and had a 1.99 ERA. He finished 13th in the MVP voting and was named AL Fireman of the Year by the Sporting News. On September 7, 1966, Aker earned save number 30 for the season with 3.2 innings of shutout relief versus the Angels. On April 29, 1967, he pitched the last 8.1 innings of a 15-inning loss to the Boston Red Sox, striking out a career-high 8 and allowing just 2 runs. On April 24, 1968, Aker, in just the 8th baseball game ever played at the Oakland Alameda County Coliseum, pitched the last 5 innings, allowing no runs and earning the W in an 11-inning win over the Yankees. After a series of run-ins with A's owner Charles O'Finley, Aker, who was the team's union player rep, was made available in the expansion draft for the 69 season and was picked up by the Seattle Pilots. As one of their original players on April 8, 1969, he earned a save in the first game in franchise history, a 4-3 win over the Angels. His career got a second win when he was traded to the Yankees that May, and he ended up with a string of 33-plus consecutive scoreless innings, still a Yankee regular season record. He led the Yankees in saves that year and finished both 1969 and 1970 with ERAs of 2.06, despite career-threatening back surgery in the intervening winter. He remained a mainstay of the Yankee bullpen until his trade to the Cubs in 1972, when New York's acquisition of Sparky Weill from Boston made Aker expendable. Aker pitched almost 3 seasons in the NL and was standing in the bullpen, feet away from where teammate Hank Aaron's historic 715th home run landed on April 8, 1974. After his playing days ended, Aker managed the minor leagues in 75-85, winning the Governor's Cup, the International League Championship, with the 1982 Tidewater Tides, the Met organization. So he was a great manager for the Mets in the minor leagues, and then he became the Cleveland Indians pitching coach from 85 to 87. He left pro baseball after the 8th season to teach children, and for 20 years offered camps, clinics, and baseball instruction through his Jack Aker Baseball Academy. In 1997, he was honored by President Clinton with a Giant Steps Award for coaching for his work in teaching at Native American children on reservations in Arizona and Mexico. Aker is of Potawatomi ancestry. Now, with the Mets, which was his last stop in the major leagues, in 1974, he went 2-1, pitching in 24 games, and he had an ERA of 3.48 and managed to save 2 games. So Jack Aker, once a Met, always a Met. And now let's remember Mike Fitzgerald. Mike Fitzgerald was born on July 13, 1960 in Long Beach, California. The six-foot catcher was drafted out of Lakewood High School at age 17 in the sixth round of the 78 draft by the Mets. He was a fine defensive catcher, getting to AAA Tidewater by 1981. He split time with Bruce Bochy as the Tide's main catcher the next season. In 83, he hit his best with 14 homers, 65 RBIs, and a .284 batting average, getting him promoted to the Mets as a September call-up. He made his spectacular MLB debut on September 13th against the Phillies at Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia. Fitzgerald blasted a homer in his first major league at-bat against, coming against Tony Gelfi in the Mets' 5-1 win. He got a hit in the second game the next day, but then was hitless in his last six games he played during the 83 season. He finished the year with those two hits, going 2-for-20 with a .100 average. Now, he won the starting catching job in 84 over veteran Ron Hodges. Hodges had finally got a chance as the team's main catcher in 83 after spending a decade as backup to Grody Duffy and Duffy Dyer and John Stearns. Fitzgerald also beat out to other top prospects, Junior Ortiz and John Gibbons, but never fulfilled the expectations the club had for him. Fitzgerald had the honor of catching rookie sensation in his electrifying 84 season. Fitz caught Gooden his debut on April 7th in Houston, and that day Gooden struck out five batters in five innings and pitching his first victory. Fitz would not catch Gooden again until May 1st. On that day, Doc earned his second win, beating the Cubs at Shea Stadium. On May 14th, Fitz was behind the plate when Gooden fanned 14 Dodgers in a 2-0 shutout at Dodger Stadium. Fitz was behind the plate for many memorable Gooden games in his rookie year season. In September, he was Doc's battery maze. He set the single season strikeout mark against the Pirates at Shea Stadium. He struck out 16 batters, a season high. 5 days later in Philadelphia, Fitz called the signals as Gooden struck out another 16 batters, though he took a 2-1 loss to Shane Raleigh. Now at the plate, he only hit .242 with two homers, 15 doubles, and 33 RBIs. Certainly not enough for a contending team's catcher to hit. From May 5th through May 15th, he drove in six runs over a five-game span, including three in a row. In mid-July, he had two separate games where he drove in three runs during the same week. Fitz was only a rookie, and his future looked bright as he made the Topps All-Star rookie team as well. Defensively, he led all catchers with a .995 fielding percentage. He is only one of five players to win a fielding title in his rookie season prior to Fitzgerald. Johnny Oates had done it with the AL East champion Baltimore Orioles in 72. Fitz also made 715 putouts, fifth in the NL, and threw out 34% of would-be Steelers. Now, in the offseason, the Mets landed a big bat and all-star catcher when they acquired Gary Carter from the Expos. Fitzgerald went to Montreal with Hubie Brooks, Herm Winningham, and Floyd Yeomans in exchange for Carter. It was one of the best trades the Mets ever made, as Carter helped them win a World Series in 86. Fitzgerald would be Montreal's main catcher for seven seasons, sharing time with Nelson Santovania in those later years. Now, here's a trivia question. Fitz would appear on a 1986 Topps Kevin Mitchell Mets baseball card. It appears the photo was taken after Mitchell had slid safely in the home in a cloud of dust and scored a run. The game took place on a beautiful Sunday afternoon at Shea Stadium. Now, Fitz would play in over 100 games four times, enjoying his best season in 86, batting .282 with six homers, 37 ribbies, and 13 doubles. Defensively, his best year came with the Mets in 84. Through the years, his fielding percentage and percentage of throwing batters out kind of fell off. In 87, he had 12 errors charged to him, second most in the NL, with a .981 fielding percentage. In 92, he signed with the Angels for one season, batting .212 in 95 games. He didn't sign with the Mariners the following season, but only played in their minor league system. Fitzgerald finished a 10-year career with 545 hits, 48 homers, 95 doubles, 293 RBIs, and a .321 on-base percentage, and a .235 batting average. He caught in 748 games behind the plate with a .987 fielding percentage, throwing out 23% of the would-be base Steelers. He is a born-again Christian, and he and his wife live in Long Beach, California with their two children. Well, that's going to wrap up another podcast for us today. Just a reminder again, big afternoon game today starting at 12:20. Chris Bassett, 6-6, going for the Metsies, 3.94 ERA. Going against Charlie Morton, 5-3 with a 4.21 ERA. Should be an epic battle today. I'll be watching it. Hopefully you can watch it or tape it and watch it tonight, whenever. And we'll be back to talk about it tomorrow. But before we sign off, we have to give you the answer to the Trivia and Jeopardy question. And we promise and we deliver. There you go. The trivia question first. Francisco Lindor and Pete Alonso both have at least 60 RBIs before the All-Star game this year. Who were the last two Met teammates to accomplish the feat? Well, the correct answer is David Wright and Carlos Beltran in 2008. Congrats to our good friend and trivia whiz John Tierney on being the first to submit the correct answer. And today's Jeopardy! Two clues, as always, traded with Sam Haggerty by the Cleveland Indians to the Mets in exchange for Kevin Pilecki on June 6, 2019. Was called up in late 2019 when Noah Syndergaard was placed on the 10-day injured list with a right hamstring strain. The correct answer, response I should say, for the Jeopardy! Is who is John Tierney? Congrats to, the answer is who is Walter Lockett? So used to saying John Tierney when I recite these back. Because he, again, got the correct answer to the response. But the correct answer is, who is Walter Lockett? Well, that's going to wrap it up for today. Enjoy your happy hump day. It's a beautiful, warm day in the New York area. And hopefully the Met bats warm up today and we beat the Braves. Again, thanks for listening. It means the world to me. And we'll speak again tomorrow. Take care and let's go, Mets.